Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Quarantine Break podcast. Today's conversation is a really good one, so I'm just going to get straight into it. I spoke to screenwriter Sarah Phelps, the writer behind some of the biggest TV shows of recent times, Dublin Murders, The Casual Vacancy, And Then There Were None, and most recently, The Pale Horse. Sarah was a wonderful guest, and I can't wait for you to hear this. Take a listen, and I'll be back at the end. Hello, Sarah. A very warm welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
The question I have to ask everyone first, and it becomes more loaded as the lockdown continues, but are you well? Are you feeling healthy?
I'm feeling quite well and healthy. The brain shatters every now and again. I had a really, really bad spate where I got extremely terrified and lay on the floor quite a lot. I think then I gave myself a good hard talking to and just thought, yeah, just have to do small things that, just small things rather than look at huge things, because the huge things are too terrifying. And obviously, clearly, because you can see me, one of the first things I did was take a set of nail scissors and dog clippers to my hair for reasons best known to myself. I don't know. I find a lot of people are doing that. It's a sort of, maybe it's an expression of that kind of anxiety, which is the change. You have to make a radical change to somehow mirror the terrifying change that's going on. And if you shave your head, basically what you feel is chilly and extremely vulnerable, and you're suddenly aware that cupboards, you don't close cupboards enough, and you should do, because when you stand up you brain yourself. But yeah, I'm quite kind of liking my,
I think it looks sort of great. I think if I did it, I would sort of just look like a dodgy potato.
Well, I won't lie. When I first did it, I kept thinking I'm going to have to put on a full face of makeup when I go out, because I do look like I lurk around to eat twitching roadkill. That's what I look like. But I've sort of grown into it. I've got used to it. But yeah, apart from that, mad moments of, you know, let's go out and plant some stuff, and let's try and cook some bread. Cook some biscuits, and Jesus fucking Christ, what is happening? What is happening? I'm terrified about what's happening in America. There are too many people with too many guns, and I feel very, very frightened for people who live in America, friends who live there. Very frightened.
The Trump press conference the other day was mad, wasn't it?
He's been mad all this time, and now it's just even more mad. But everybody seems to be mad. Like, apparently there's some Dr. Phil who's on, and he's saying, like, well you know, we don't close the country down when there are swimming pool deaths or people die from smoking cigarettes. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Are you literally, does your spinal cord not touch your brain? Are you breathing through gills? What's happening? But the other thing was, ration the news. Morning, early evening, just try and avoid, because otherwise you will go crazy.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, so, yeah, the idea of this podcast is to take a bit of a tea break from the news, and especially those WhatsApp groups where somebody's friends, brothers, sister...
Yeah, mute. Oh, yeah, people sort of like, you know, 5G conspiracy theories and the fact that somebody from down the road has been out longer than their allotted, allotted hour, and people are breaking. And you're just like, Jesus Christ, calm your shit down. So this sounds like a very good idea, yeah.
A friend of mine discovered their neighbour was a 5G conspiracy theorist. I think I'd just have to move.
Well, move or just shower sort of contempt and disbelief. It's just like, here's a pig, put it on trial. It's exactly what it is. It's witch burning. There's a really brilliant guy called Dean Burnett, who's a neuroscientist and does little kind of YouTube lectures on neuroscience and the development of the brain and why the brain does what the brain does. And he did a really interesting thing about why the human brain seeks out conspiracy theories, seeks it out and clings to it for comfort. And it's really worth checking out. He has a book called The Happy Brain as well. He's really smart. And science is very comforting, I find.
Oh, yes, definitely.
But he's really good on why we need conspiracy theories, why we find so much comfort and cleave to them so much. It's like a kind of camouflage, and we desire patterns, and conspiracy theories are proof of patterns, and we really desire patterns. It's partly for survival and partly for community and social cohesion.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's fascinating.
I'll put the link in the bio because, yeah, science is something good to cling on to at the moment.
Yeah, so, but it is, it's an interesting thing. If it, you know, 1,000 years ago, whatever, not even 1,000 years ago, not even that far back, you know, pigs would be put on trial. And I've just finished reading The Mirror and the Light, where they're burning people for all sorts of, you know, reasons of what their faith is or what they believe or what they read or how they, you know, what language they write the word of God in. And you just think, you know, we're never that really far away from these people at all.
Yeah,
it all
yeah.
just lurks there under our skin, just waiting, you know, any more than all those right-wing loons parading with their massive assault rifles. What do they think they're going to do, shoot the virus? I mean, anyway...
I noticed you had a tea there. What kind of tea are you having? What kind of blend?
I'm actually having a cup of coffee, and I'm a very, very lazy coffee maker. Like, I have lots of nice coffee and those really nice little, like, my favourite one is a Vesuvio, those little pots that you put on the stove and then they bubble up.
Lovely.
I just love the kind of, like, the basic alchemy of it, where there's nothing in the little top pot, and then it's full of coffee and it's all spitting and bubbling. It's really exciting. But I'm extremely lazy, so that, I'm afraid, is a cup of instant coffee. And for my tea, Yorkshire Gold.
Oh, lovely.
Yorkshire Gold or we will fight.
I had Rufus Jones on the podcast last week, and I don't know if you knew this before you worked with him on the casual vacancy, but he doesn't like tea.
The fuck? Oh, he kept that under his hat. He kept that quiet.
I don't know why he hired him.
I don't even trust him. Rufus, I can't look at you. He's not a tea drinker.
No. And some of the characters he's played, like very, very sort of straight-laced Englishmen.
I know. He's just revealed this deep vein of depravity.
Yeah.
Deep, deep vein of depravity. That's one of my favourite TV moments, I've got to say, is Rufus Jones stark naked.
Oh, it was wonderful, wasn't it?
In a glass office, wielding a yucca plant, screaming about Brexit. I thought it was one of my highlights. Phenomenal. Yeah, so I'm a coffee, tea. I can't stand Earl Grey. I don't understand Earl Grey. Why is it? Who drinks it and why? I like a nice orange brew, good orange brew. So you can trot a mouse on it, as my granny used to say.
That's a lovely expression.
I know. It's got to be, you know, stewed. That's how she liked her tea, stewed.
I always mention this at this point in the show, but we are on video chat today, as we of course are social distancing, although as a friend pointed out the other day, whenever I say video chat I sound like I'm 107.
Yeah. What is is it then? Video conferencing, house party? What do you call it?
I don't know. I just sound very old when I say video chat, apparently.
I sound very old all the time. I've got no idea what anybody is talking about most of the time. And one of my my mum's neighbours over the road, their daughter is a drummer. And I was like, oh, look at that, you know. Slapping that was stone cold badass queen slapping her skins. I just thought, if you'd ever tried to sound more of a sad, pathetic, middle-aged old bitch, you just did it. You just did it. And I felt covered in shame.
But have you been using video calling apps to kind of like keep connected with people?
Yeah. So basically This is an advent of the new thing. Like before, I was never really into FaceTime because, I mean, like, I was just like, no, why? God, it's bad enough. You know, I don't want to see people or have people see me or see what I'm doing. But now I'm loving it, just seeing people's faces. And we've got the we have work. I was doing some work as this pandemic and came and everybody went into lockdown. And I was in a position where contractually I had to deliver some scripts. While this was going on, I was like, Christ almighty. I my brain felt like broken glass. It's like, how the hell am I going to do this? But myself and my script editor is Canadian and had gone back to Canada to self-isolate in her parents' basement. So her from her parents' basement, me here and my fellow execs in Essex and in another part of the country, basically having script meetings on sort of Zoom and it was just like, This is how quickly we become attuned to this new version of normal. And I hate meetings at the best of time. I absolutely hate them. And there's always a point where I think it took me so long to give up smoking was because a cigarette was a really good reason to leave a meeting. So I could just get up and go outside for 20 minutes and come back. So I hate sitting in rooms with people. but I quite... I think this is, you know, it's astonishing how swiftly we adapt to something so that we can, those of us who were lucky enough to still have some sort of work can carry on doing it. And I'm reading through Twitter and like there are people I really revere and love and admire and they're just like, what the hell happens now? Yeah. And it just makes me very frightened for them. But yeah, there's been a lot of video conferencing and a lot of family WhatsApp and family Zoom and things like that, where me and my brothers just end up sort of like flicking V signs at each other like total children and not middle-aged old farts.
You just mentioned you've just finished some scripts. So creatively, are you finding this a challenging time? Like I'm really struggling to kind of get my brain into any kind of gear at the moment.
I think the difficulty was... the scripts I was writing were actually about the world, about the 2008 financial crash. Mm. And I think what helped was the idea that suddenly, almost overnight, the world as you know it is no more.
Yeah.
No more. Everything is snapped. Everything is gone. The horizons are completely tilted and the roof has fallen in. And so even though I was like, I can't even, sometimes you know yourself, you know, you think, I don't even understand what sentences are. What are words? Why are words? What are these people doing? How are they touching each other? Why are they in the same room? Why aren't they wearing gloves? At the same time, there's something about the fact that everybody is in a state of trauma, grief, fear, betrayal, that they're flooded with cortisol. And that kind of made sense for what I was writing. And I've got to get on and write another. I'm getting on to write another project and cranking my brain up to it at the moment. And again, you think, what on earth has this got to do with anything that we're going through now? And in order to kind of like find some fellow feeling, you thought, I was just reasoning to myself, every single one of these characters is flooded with cortisol. Every single one of them is. And every single one of them is desperately trying to hang on to the world as they knew it.
Yeah.
And it's just not going to happen. So even though I'm not writing about a pandemic or about the terror that comes when you're everything you're used to, everything you take for granted, and we do take for granted. I mean, I'm sure our reaction is part is a sign of our overwhelming privilege. I mean, if you suffered from, you know, Ebola outbreaks or SARS or anything like that, you kind of go, here it comes again.
Yeah.
And we've been so, you know, luxuriating in our sort of like, I don't know, our entitlement, I suppose, that the shock is even greater. Oh, shit, look, it's happening to us. But all the same time that you just take those feelings and plunge them into your characters that you're writing now, even if they're 200 years ago or 100 years ago.
I read that you were once stuck on an EastEnders script and you just added more filth, which is also another way to go.
Oh, yeah, I made it into a porn. So it was, you know, sometimes you were just kind of, oh, you're sort of sitting, you go, I don't know how to start this or how to generate the kind of roller coaster of this really matters, this is really important for, and I just ended up sort of like the door gets kicked in and Phil comes in and bends somebody over the sink and his knickers flying and, no, don't, Phil, what you're doing, shut it, just take it. And then you kind of get three pages in where, you know, there's just cum dripping off the ceiling. You know, like, well, I'll delete that now and I'll go back. And this is something to do with the arches. I don't know. But you have to get these things off your chest. At least you're writing. At least you're putting words down on a page.
A lot of people are working from home for the first time and conceivably for the foreseeable. Do you have any tips? I remember Rufus Jones saying that when he asked you about writing, for example, you were just like, "Oh, fucking write it."
There is that. At some point, you have to just sit down and go and do it. You have to just sit down and do it. And you know, I mean, it's lovely to, and I love. I'm very self-indulgent. I've sort of floated around and go, oh, I can't. I just stop feeling it today. And it's not about feeling it. It's about sitting down and hammering. And sometimes, I don't know, just dragging it out. And if you look back at the work you've done over a day and like one sentence or one phrase doesn't want to make you kind of break a bottle and jab the ends into your neck, then you're doing great. Yeah. And in fact, you're doing great anyway. But there comes a point where you sit there and you hammer it out. And if anything, just sort of thinking that all of the feelings that you're feeling now, like absolute terror, anxiety, strange moments of overwhelming euphoria, inertia, exhaustion, anxiety, grief, that you put it, you, even if you're not writing about a pandemic, you put all those feelings into what you're writing about, how startling they are and how quickly they move from one to the other, from overwhelming anxiety to a really peculiar jubilation at something really odd and strange. Like, there was a deer. I live in the country and I was sort of was awake quite early in the morning, because I generally am awake very early in the morning because I sleep like a sack of shit. And I looked out the window and there's a small deer just walking down the road. You know, and we do get deer on the road quite a lot. But I normally, if I saw that, I'd think, oh, God, there'll be something to pick up. It'll be dead. It won't make it. Somebody will hit it. And just thought, no, you're fine. You're fine. You saunter, you meander. And there's strange little things like that, which just give you these bolts of unalloyed happiness and then the anxiety again. But you just have to, put it into what you're working on, however you can. Are you watching Devs?
Oh, yeah, I am, yeah.
It's so beautiful. It's sort of
wonderful,
narcotic and terrifying.
Yeah.
And that soundtrack, I mean, you can't really call it a soundtrack. It's like it's another character, the way a really good soundtrack should be. But it's like having a really, really highly stropped razor just lightly scraping at your synapses.
It's so good.
I just think it's so beautiful. It's so kind of like lush and austere, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I've actually put a note here to talk about Devs, because I saw that you tweeted about it and I watched it last night for the first time. I've only seen the first episode, but yeah, fucking hell, so good.
I watched it's one of those things I'm like, because I can't make my brain understand things like science.
Yeah.
I can't be, and any time I have to think of math, and even if I have to write down a phone number, I have to put a post-it note over it so I can only see two numbers at the same time. Otherwise, they start multiplying and flipping themselves upside down. So looking at a TV screen filled with the kind of cascade of code, you can imagine it's like having a fucking anxiety attack as far as I'm concerned. Just like, this is my normal life when I'm trying to take down a phone number. But it's, I just think it's just astonishing. There is a bit in episode 2 where I made an involuntary noise.
Oh, amazing.
And the involuntary noise was, oh! but I've just sort of like, through Adam Rutherford, who helped out with the research, and has worked with Alex Garland before, I believe, but I think in Ex Machina and things like that. And I've sort of found that all the people who work on the FX and work on the soundtrack, just saying to them, this is, you know, I'm much, much older than you, so I can remember the first time I saw Singer Detective and go, oh, TV can do this. Not just Singer Detective, but there was a version of Baal, the Brecht play, in which David Bowie was Baal.
Yeah.
And I, it's one of those things where you go, oh, I see. Singer Detective and Baal, television can do this. And when I'm watching Devs, I think the same thing. Oh, I see, television can do this. How absolutely astonishing and exciting and rich and numinous and utterly, utterly terrifying.
Yeah, oh, my head exploded in that first episode. I sort of want to save it, though, because it looks so...
It's interesting you should say that, because one of the people who worked on the FX said, you know what, don't binge it. Mm. Let it roll around.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things where you need to, like, there's so many shows you can binge. You just go bang, 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 and it does end up washing over you. And I'm doing the same with Better Call Saul, which is I'm just going to write just two episodes max. I'm not going to do the thing where I just race through because you just don't take it in. But I think this guy is right, because once you're so kind of drunk in a good way, like, you need to kind of like readjust back into the normal physical world.
Yeah.
So I think he's right. I think I'm going to really be sparse with it.
And I like that Nick Offerman is a little bit Ron Swanson-ish in it.
It's like a combination of being somebody in profound state of depression, somebody entirely consumed with grief, and completely and utterly psychopathic the same time.
I've been watching so much TV in the past week. We've spoken about Devs. What else have you been watching?
I watched the first episode of Run, which I really enjoyed
very
much.
Oh, it was really good, wasn't it?
I am completely obsessed with The Repair Shop on BBC. BBC,
it's
which
amazing,
is,
isn't it?
I just love it. Julia Rayside says, oh, it's a barn full of sexy bagpusses. And I just think, it is a barn full of sexy bagpusses. I absolutely love it. I love seeing people who are really brilliant at doing things like that.
Yeah.
And the care and the attention and the skill and the expertise. It's beautiful. It's really, really beautiful. And I rewatched all of Wolf Hall just because, you know, and obsessed with cooking shows, makeover shows, anything that's vague, anything that it's really weird because it's anything that's vaguely comforting, like a nice cooking show, compared to Wolf Hall, which is the most uncomforting thing completely. Mm. And there's a lovely film on called Their Finest, which is a total joy, and it's about people making propaganda films during World War II. It is absolutely lovely.
It's a lovely film.
Oh, I absolutely love it. It's gorgeous. But I'm going to have to fight shy of anything that's too obviously scary because I don't know if I've got the emotional capacity to withstand it at the moment.
Well, yeah.
Don't mind, right? I mean, like, obviously Devs is... But but anything... I can't do horror. Can you do horror?
No, I mean...
I once saw the trailer for The Babadook and I cried.
Yeah, I'm not a horror person. I mean,
I can't.
I mean, so many people have been sort of tweeting about these, you know, beautiful documentaries they've been watching recently, and I've been feeling quite guilty because I've just been dipping back into Friends.
I think that's fine. I tell you what else is good is Unorthodox on Netflix.
Yes,
it's and the actress in that, Shira Haas, is astonishing. She's absolutely astonishing. It's brilliant. Just comforting things. That's what you need to do. That's what you need to do. But I'm rubbish with horror. And even to this day, I have to watch something like Don't Look Now or The Shining through a buttonhole so that I can close it if it gets too much. And, you know, even the do you remember that, you know, Alton Towers, they've got a Saw ride.
Yes, yeah.
I can't watch the advert for it. It makes me too anxious. And it just makes me feel like I'm going to wee myself or something. It's just too much. I can't bear it.
We were at a time when people were saying, oh, there's too much great TV at the moment. And now so many TV shows have been put on hiatus. But I think the thing that really sort of brought it home for me was when things like EastEnders or Corrie stopped filming. It was like when they switched off Big Ben, but people outside the Houses of Parliament gave a fuck.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I think people will give a fuck. It is.
Yeah.
It's not quite Ravens leaving the Tower, but, you know, especially with Corrie, which has been going for so long. But EastEnders, which, of course, is my beloved warped child.
Yeah.
You do think, well, obviously all the writers will still be writing and getting ahead and planning ahead and planning ahead. But it is difficult to think, when are those shows going to be able to be stood up again?
Yeah.
And, you know, from my point of view, when you're thinking about, well, how will production work in the future? Like, obviously, shows that have got, say, two episodes left to shoot will have to try and get those in. But shows that were in, like, soft prep and that are maybe shooting with multiple locations over the world, you can't see that happening, can you?
No, not at all.
And also, imagine trying to crew up when, say, if you get a vaccine and everything's lifted and we go back to life as before. The idea of trying to crew up when there's this huge bottleneck and great big streaming giants like Netflix will be just like hoovering it all up.
Well,
it's going to be really, really, really tricky. I wonder how all the smaller streaming platforms will cope. But what really comes across so much is the value of film and TV and theatre and music and dance and the creative industries. Everybody is streaming. You've got some fantastic things, you know, like Wise Children is on iPlayer. You've got the RSC streaming shows, you've got the National Theatre streaming shows. You think, thank God. Yeah. And in the future, I think the attention will be like, these are so important as industries. Stop belittling them.
Yes.
Stop belittling the skills that go into them. In the same way that we now know who the key workers are, and they're the people who are paid least in our society.
Yeah.
We don't have them, we don't have shit.
One of the suggestions for EastEnders, if we do run out of episodes, is to rerun classic ones. Do you have any favourite episodes of yours that you hope they show again?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Peggy Mitchell's death is obviously a huge fan favourite.
Oh, Peggy Mitchell. Well, yeah, bringing back Pat as a ghost. I love doing that. Because, of course, who would you want? Who would you want at the end? You wouldn't want any of your lovers or your husbands or even your kids. You want the face you'd slapped 1,000 times. You'd want Pat all lit up like a Woolworths Christmas tree. That's who you'd want to see you across the river. And they're such a pair of dames, those two. I love them so much. It was the sheer pleasure of thinking, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to... Because you know that that when you've got like a tumour in your brain or some kind of brain disturbance or injury, you can smell burning.
Mm.
And the idea that every time Peggy thought, oh, God, I'm losing it, I keep smelling burning, that actually every single time that happened, it was Pat with her cigarette just there. Just as, and instead of being terrifying, it was comfort.
Oh, that's lovely. You wrote quite a lot of the Den stuff as well.
Oh, yeah, I had loads of bloody Den. You know, brought him back from the dead, killed him with Pauline Fowler's dog-shaped doorstop, which might be a fun one to watch, and then dug him up. And then Sam Mitchell went mad on vodka and dug him up during Sharon and Dennis's wedding. To the sound of the Ride of the Valkyries, which in a strange subplot, I had Ian Wynn as a CD of Hooked on Opera in a box of cereal, and he just sort of annoyed the square by kept playing it. So those sorts of things. And the other ones which I was really proud of, like I was really, really proud of Stacey Slater going home to look after her mum, and you realise that this bolshy, stroppy little girl, that she's a child, she's been a child carer all her life.
Yeah.
And she's lived more life than you could ever possibly imagine. The killing of Paul Truman, I absolutely love, because Gary Beale is a phenomenal actor, and the pleasure of writing for an actor of that caliber as well is just fantastic. But who knows? I've written a lot. I did a lot.
Do you miss EastEnders writing for it?
Yeah, I think you always do. It's always there in little, a piece of my heart will always be Wolford, always be E20. I absolutely loved my time there, and I loved popping back for a visit, and I loved all the depth to those characters and the way to think about them. You know, I always thought that they're the Furies from ancient Greek tragedy, but they've got acrylic nails and extensions, and they're Margaret d'Anjou and Eleanor of Aquitaine wading thigh high through the blood of their enemies, carrying a Primark bag.
Oh, it's lovely.
You know, it's that great big, those huge mythic things, those huge mythic themes played out in this tiny little plot of land. And I mean, there's nothing, and I love it because you take a peroxided EastEnders matriarch and you plonk her down in front of her worst enemy, and all that's there on the table is a bottle of gin and a packet of cigarettes and you've got half an hour. I just absolutely love it. I love it still.
I
hope to see it back soon. Oh, can I make another TV recommendation?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so on iPlayer, there is a half-hour pilot for a comedy called Alma's Not Normal.
Oh, yes.
And it is half an hour of joy. It is wonderful. It's got the most fantastic cast. The jokes are laugh out loud. It's heartbreaking. It's human. It's warm. It's hilarious. It's dirty. It's filthy. It's funny. It's lovely. It's really, really, really smashing, and now I want like three series of it.
Yeah, it's on my watch list.
It's really great. It's really fantastic.
The cast, I think, is also really, really good.
Oh, it's amazing. Lorraine Ashbourne, Siobhan Finner, and it's really great. It's really just, you know, like when you're having your lunch or you're having your coffee break, Alma's Not Normal on iPlayer. It's fantastic.
What about books? Are you reading books at the moment? Have you got the headspace to read books at the moment?
Yeah, but I listen to a lot of audiobooks because then I can do stuff around the house, take the dogs for a walk. And when I'm working, the sort of the time that I've got for reading is time that also has to be walking the dogs or going to the supermarket or doing whatever. So I'm always plugged into an audiobook. And I've been The Mirror and the Light, the final instalment of the Hilary Mantel trilogy. And when I got to the end, I was absolutely floored. I was bereft and devastated. I thought, I'm in tears. I am heartbroken for a man who was executed 500 years ago. It's so good. It's so good. And what I'm reading now is I'm listening to, I've just finished Kate Atkinson's Life After Life.
Mm.
Again, re-listening to that. And I do a lot of that, like revisiting. I've been reading plays that I wanted to go and see and I'm not going to be able to see now. So I just finished reading The Welkin by Lucy Kirkwood, which is completely brilliant. And I mentioned that on Twitter, and Jonathan Harvey pointed me towards a series on Channel 4 that's going to be coming up that Lucy Kirkwood has written. It's called Adult Behaviour. And I watched the trailer for it. Oh, my God, it looks absolutely fantastic. Yes, it's got Hayley Squires in it, and it's got Rupert Everett in one of the most astonishing wigs. And it looks brilliant.
He's worn many over the years.
Oh, I literally cannot wait for this. It looks amazing. So if you've got a bit of time and you're fooling around, just go onto the Channel 4 website and Adult Behaviour trailer and just go, I cannot wait to see this. It just looks fantastic. Lucy Kirkwood is a brilliant, brilliant writer. So I'm reading a lot of plays and poetry and listening to a lot of novels and watching a lot of TV and putting up a lot of fairy lights. And every now and again, I read some of my own research for the next project I've got to do and go, really, what are you talking about? Because to write, I like to fill up, and then I fill up with everything, and then I just splurge it out. So at some point I'll sit down and it will all splurge. I'll beat it out somehow.
Is there anything else that you're doing to kind of take your mind off? Are you a meditation app person?
Oh, fuck no. Jesus Christ. I'm not very good at those sorts of things. Yeah. And I always find that when somebody starts talking to me in a calming voice, I either go to sleep or I want to punch them. I find that I'm generally quite tightly wound as a human being anyway. And when people sort of, now, remember, you are worth breathing for, so deep breath. And you're like, you fucking patronized me, you bastard. And so that really isn't my thing at all. And I generally tend to, well, I'll go for a long walk with the dogs, and I always find like drinking heavily is quite good. I'm a huge fan of wine.
Well, happy hour can be any hour now, I think.
A friend of mine just sent me a bottle of violet and honey gin, which is a really alarming kind of purple colour. It's absolutely delicious. So you sort of get to, you know, you sort of look at your clock and think, is the sun over the yard on a Friday? Not really. But meditation apps, no, they're not for me. They're not for me at all.
Anytime I see one of these social media challenges at the moment, like that, that's enough to make me want to drink.
Yeah, no, social media challenges to do what? No, what, learn another language? No, leave me alone. Do something? No, leave me alone. I want to lie on the sofa right now. Tomorrow I might get up and do something else. But other than that, I really hate Christmas and New Year because I hate being told when to have fun.
Yeah.
Boxing Day, bang on. January the 3rd, bring it to me. I love it. But, you know, people go, yay, it's New Year. So fucking what? Yay, it's Christmas Day. Yeah, Jesus Christ. It's just a big roast dinner and everyone drinking tea and flushing the toilet too much. I'm such a miserable bastard. But, yeah, no, social media challenges, not for me. Anything like that. Meditation.
Yeah.
It works for a lot of people. Doesn't work for me. It just makes me angry. just makes me furious. Just makes me violent.
I had been wanting to chat about how an Agatha Christie style murder mystery in the world of self-isolation and quarantine would work. But I sort of think isolation seems like a big theme in her work anyway.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, and then there were none. You've never that is a pure lockdown situation. I suppose we're in a locked room murder mystery. Well, you know, hopefully not too much murder. Let's not make light of that. And anyway, you always get those things of isolation because people are so riven with guilt and shame for the thing that they've done that they hope no one's ever going to find out about. I wonder how you'd do it. You could, I suppose, a Zoom murder mystery. I don't know how that would work. I'm not sure that I want to think about murder too much during this time. That feels like a safe thing to think. It feels... feels like that might just send me off the deep end.
Although I read, like most people and certainly myself, you grew up reading Ian Fleming as opposed to Agatha Christie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's that you always, when you're sort of transitioning from children's books and you're really aware that there are grown-up books with grown-up themes, and you kind of grab onto whatever's on the bookshelf set. And there was never any Agatha Christie at home. I don't know why. There was a lot of Naomi Marsh And at my grandparents' house, where I used to go and stay, they had every single Ian Fleming in a long line. And it's not the sort of thing I should have been reading as a sort of 9-year-old, 10-year-old, but I absolutely devoured them. And I do honestly think it's played quite a large part in how my kind of, how I've kind of developed as a human being. Because they are, when you look back on them, it's interesting what you kind of accept as a child and go, that seems perfectly normal. Yeah. That seems like a perfectly normal way to talk to somebody. And then when you look back, you go, that is high-level sadomasochism. Yeah. Should I really have been reading that? Well, probably not at all, but there we are. You grab onto it. And so I had never, ever, until I read And Then There Were None, I'd never read any Agatha Christie. So I was so, because I really, really thought that it would be sort of, I don't know, just a little bit safe, just a little bit English villages.
Yeah.
And I'd never watched an adaptation all the way through. Of course, you're aware of who plays them and the fact that the big cinematic things, or, you know, Peter Ustinov, like Death on the Nile and things like that, were a huge cinematic treat, and they were waspish and bitchy and glamorous. But I never saw them. I never, ever saw them. And when Damien Timmer from Mammoth said, read And Then There Were None, I was really so genuinely shocked by what it was. Yeah, it really took my breath away, because you kind of think, oh, it's going to be a little old lady, and or more to the point, here's a beautiful country house and someone's lying on the rug and there's got a poker in their eye and nobody really cares, and later on they'll all be called around and they'll stand there while they're lit, where their crimes are read out, and nobody tries to run away for, you know, and it's not that at all. They are really, really quite astonishingly, I was quite astonished by the brutality of it. So I think that was really good for doing those adaptations, because I could be shocked rather than familiar.
Yeah.
Everything was unfamiliar, so I could go, what's that doing there? Rather than going, being so hampered, I suppose, by the familiarity or by the, I think you get really involved with who you were when you read a book.
Yeah.
And what it meant to you. So, say, for example, if I had read it, you know, perhaps when I was you know, staying somewhere, you could imagine there'd be some sort of like a slightly illicit thrill, but, you know, you'd smell the smell of the house or the smell of baking, or if it was raining outside, or whether you were getting over mumps or a cold, and you become very involved with the memory of who you were and where you were when you first read. And that can be quite romantic, that kind of nostalgia, and it can blind you to what the book is.
Yeah.
So not having had that familiarity and only having unfamiliarity and shock, I think that kind of stood me in good stead.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of shock, like, so many people were shocked about the ending of The Pale Horse. Like, I was looking at it recently, and I think 8.5 million searches in Google about the Pale Horse ending. Have you enjoyed people's theories about that ending?
Yeah, of course I have. I mean, it's this is quite interesting. Okay, so I belong to a local volunteer organisation for, you know, getting groceries and medications for people who are vulnerable. And I went and did some shopping for a lady in who's a neighbour, and I was dropping her shopping off at the drive, and her neighbours were out raking their lawn, and the bloke came over, I don't know, sort of late 50s, and he went, you're the author. And I went, well, strictly speaking, I'm not, but I'm a screenwriter. And he went, like, you're the one that does the Christies. And he was sort of pointing his finger at me, and I went, like, oh, God, yeah, I am, yeah. And he said, what did it mean? What was it supposed to mean? It didn't mean anything. What did it mean about the Pale Horse? And quite angry, I said, well, it's about guilt, and it's about paranoia and sin and shame, and how you can never, ever, ever escape the things you've done.
Yeah.
Never. And he sort of looked at me for a long, long moment and then hefted his rake and went, maybe I'll watch it again. I was really keen to give it an ending which had bought into the kind of like the witchcraft thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, because, you know, all of that, and interestingly, I mean, like, it really, I mean, I suppose it's quite prescient when you think about people believing about 5G conspiracies and things like that, because here you've got a profoundly rational man who ends up believing that witches are real, and ends up believing that witches are trying to kill him, and ends up believing that only witches can save him from his certain death, and that he wants to buy a curse, and he believes that curse is going to make him immortal. A totally rational man with a television who believes in science, who believes in all of these things, ends up being stripped of all his certainties, so he believes in the sort of the strangest, darkest superstitions and paranoias of who we are. He ends up believing it and only realizes, you know, that where he goes, Christ, it was you all along. It was you all along. You know, the banality of evil. All along, it was just a mean, horrible, cruel little man. And then just almost tying it up and going, well, you know what? What if it was real? What if there was a curse? What if something had been said against him, and this thing that he dreamed all along, this was going to be his hell, to relive over and over and over again the precise moment at which he ended his own life. Mm. Because you commit a murder, you don't just end that person's life, you end your own life. If you've got anything about you, you end your own life. It will never leave you. And so that's what I wanted to do. And there were, you know, the novel has a much more prosaic ending, which is everybody gets married and they have a happy time and the dogs get treated for ringworm and it's just, so what? But I always find with Christie, there's a tension between the book she wants to write and the book she knows people wants to read.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so there's always that sense of, well, here's your happy ending. And that happy ending thing only comes in. I'm going to go off on a bit of a rant now. Is that okay with you?
Oh, please do.
Okay, this happy ending thing really, really comes in with her after she does a theatre adaptation, a theatre production of And Then There Were None. And as we all know, in And Then There Were None, the novel, it is extremely brutal, extremely remorseless. It's like the ancient Greeks. You can't escape. You can't run away. Action bigots, action. You are heading towards your face. And it is a white-eyed, remorseless oblivion. It doesn't care how much you beg and plead and twist. You are not going to get away. You are going to fucking die. And there's nothing you can do about it. So after the Second World War, Agatha Christie is in New York, where a version of And Then There Were None is going to be put on. And the theatre producer say to her, and I paraphrase all of this, you know, this is, I'm turning it into an anecdote, but the theatre producer say to her, look, everybody's been through a lot. We need a happy ending. Mm. She's going like, happy ending. Yeah, I need a happy ending. And in this version, the happy ending that they want is that Philip Lombard and Vera Claythorne don't die. They escape the island. They walk away into the sunset. A child killer and a serial killer escape and walk away into the sunset hand in hand. It's turned into a rom-com. And I always think about Agatha Christie, who is, she's cute. She's cute when it comes to money. She needs to be.
Yeah.
She goes like, I'll take the money and I'll write you a happy ending. This is the happy ending that you want? This says so much about you, but you have that happy ending. And I think that she doesn't believe it. She doesn't believe it, but if that's what you want. And after that, you get this strange creation of happy endings where there shouldn't really be any.
Yeah.
And I think it's that thing with her, well, I don't necessarily think that she believes people need happy endings. She's gone through two world wars. She's seen all of it. She was a serving vat for the entirety of the First World War. She knows that there isn't happy endings. She knows that there's obliteration and blasted flesh and broken minds. But if this is what you want, this is what you can have. Let's see if you question it.
Yeah.
And I always think she leaves these little clues to see if you're paying attention to what she's really talking about. And so what I do is I see what I think is a clue, like a discordancy in the narrative, something that is there that shouldn't really be there. And I do a deep dive on that, and that is where I come up with my versions. Also, And anyway, weirdly, I was asleep on the floor one night because I'd had too much wine, and I woke up and there was a film on ITV4 whatever, and I was watching it for a bit, sort of stunned. I was like, what the fuck is this? Oliver Reed in a massive turtleneck jumper and an actress, a Swedish actress whose name escapes me at this particular moment in time, wearing almost nothing because obviously,
yes,
you know, running around this strange old house. And then suddenly Richard Attenborough turns up, seemingly covered in cobwebs and flaky skin. And I suddenly realised what I was watching was And Then There Were None. And I was watching the version where Lombard and Vera Claythorne escape happy.
So like strange. It
turned into a kind of erotic thriller.
Yeah.
And it always makes me think that if she's going to change something, she'll change it, but she's doing it with an edge. She's doing it to see what the public reaction is to it. Like, can you forget what these people have done? That woman killed a child. Mm. That man is a serial killer, and he doesn't give a fuck. And the only thing that Vera really minds about what she did is not that she killed the child. It's that it didn't work to get her what she wanted. You want a happy ending?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And I always find there's a kind of real, a real bitter, dark sarcasm to her happy endings. Really, you've gone through all of this, and this is what you want. You really want the tea on the lawn and all is well with the world. You have looked into the eyes of evil. Mm. You have conjured the devil, but now you're going to get married and have tea on the lawn. Okay, okay, if that's what you want. But I'm just going to put that little clue over here to see if that roiling little worm of disquiet means anything to you at all.
Well, it's one of the things I love about your adaptations, because you sort of unpick that psychological wreckage that lingers for the characters.
Yeah, definitely. And also the psychological wreckage that is brought to them through the world that they live in. Like in Witness for the Prosecution, the wreckage, psychological, social, economic of the First World War on those characters. That was the other character in the room, the aftermath, the long shadow, the dead, the mud, the howling, inconsolable grief, the trauma. That was the long shadow cast across all of them. And what I really wanted to do was to have the times in which they're in cast that shadow over all of those characters. The 1933 for the ABC murders, for Hercule Poirot, what the rise of the British Union of Fascists means for Hercule Poirot. And to make him unfamiliar as well, like throughout in the script, he doesn't get called, unless people, you know, whenever his character name comes up, it is always Hercule, not Poirot, Hercule, so that he becomes slightly unfamiliar. And somebody messaged me on Twitter and said, you've ruined my childhood. I mean, you're so pathetic. You're such a snowflake making Poirot into a refugee. It's just like, what the fuck? He is, canonically, he is a refugee. And canonically, he is called Papa Poirot. And canonically, he is a devout Catholic.
Mm.
And canonically, he calls groups of adults mes enfants. Who does that? A teacher? A teacher calls groups of children mes enfants. The only person who calls groups of adults mes enfants is a man who has been used to being called papa. Mon père. Father. I don't pull this shit out of the air.
Finally, I have to mention Dublin Murders, because like most of the country, I was obsessed. It was fucking amazing. In a time when I could leave my house, I chose not to, which I still have no regrets.
Thank you very much.
Still have no regrets. You're working on series 2. Can you tell us anything?
I've written 2 episodes. I'm really proud of them. I think we have to see what happens with the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think there's going to be so many people in and so many productions and so many projects in exactly the same position, which is the world has changed and we have absolutely no idea what is going to happen. So we wait and see. We live in hope.
Sarah, thank you so much for spending the time to chat to me today.
It's been a real pleasure.
Well, how good was that? Didn't I tell you? I honestly could have spoken to Sarah all day. Oh, it was such a fun conversation. Most of the time, I try and keep in absolutely everything the guest says. But on this occasion, she told me some great stuff about one of her up-and-coming projects, the second series of A Very English Scandal. But I've omitted it from this show, as it would have spoiled some of the very big twists that story is going to take. But trust me, it is going to be massive, and I cannot wait to see how she brings the story of the Duchess of Argyll to our screens. Oh, it sounds good. A huge thank you to Sarah for taking the time out for this podcast. This is still a brand new show, so please spread the word, but from at least 2 meters. If you like what you heard, give us a review and as many stars as you're able to give. This has been episode 3 of the Quarantine Break podcast. I'll be back soon, but in the meantime, please stay indoors.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.